We're doing a session on liturgical dance, past, present, and future. And we're going to talk somewhat about this, and then if we have some time, we may do some actual participation, but mainly we're going to talk. So come on, bring yourselves up here, folks. I want to give you just a little sketch about the past in terms of liturgical dance, and I'm assuming that you all are relatively clear about what I mean when I'm talking about liturgical dance. Hi, come on in. That we're talking about dance movement that is used in the churches for the purpose of worship. And that can be seen in one of two ways. It can be for the purpose of people engaging in a worship experience so that they're kind of spectators, or the people who are actually engaged in a worship experience as participants. And we'll come back to that a little bit later because I want us to talk about that. And I'm making an assumption that most of you all here have grown up in Western culture, Western civilization, in mainline churches in the United States of America, and have probably discovered that there is not a whole lot of what we call liturgical dance in the tradition of the mainline churches in this country. Now, interestingly enough, historically, we have had quite a lot of liturgical dance, and I want to kind of give you a very brief overview of that, and just to give you some background for the fact that it is not a new thing. It's a very ancient form, as a matter of fact, and certainly precedes Christianity. We know that a primitive man moved and danced in order to celebrate, in order to praise, in order to express his and her awe at the mystery of the world. And those dances were what we would call religious dances. And I'm sure you have some sense for that. Dance was done when people died. Dance was done when men went out to hunt. Dancing was done for the good of the crops. Dancing was done for the harvest, a good harvest. Any rites of passage as people were going from being babies to young children, going into puberty, going into marriage, going into death, these are rites of passage. There were always dances done for these times, because this is what primitive man knew to do. And we can talk about two kinds of dancing, and I don't want to get us too hung up on that, but I do think that this is one of the reasons that we've had such why our mainline churches in this country have been very leery of dance. We can talk about convulsive dance. This is a word used by some of our dance historians. And we can talk about harmonic dance forms. Some of the our primitive tribes, and this is still in existence today, did what we call convulsive dancing, which is can be a free form, doesn't have to be a free form of movement, that gets people into what we would call an ecstatic state, and takes them into trance. And sometimes this is pretty rowdy stuff. Now, it doesn't have to be. Harmonic dances done over a long period of time. Harmonic generally refers to movements that are in harmony with the body. Convulsive can be movements that are out of harmony in the body. Distortions, things if you saw me do something like this, you would think, gee, is that something you know, I want to do? And you see me do something like this, and you think, oh, yeah, that probably feels wonderful. That's a pretty raw example of the difference between something that's convulsive and perhaps out of harmony with the body and something that's harmonic in harmony with the body. Both of these states, both of these forms of dancing can take us into trance and ecstasy. But once in trance and ecstasy, sometimes people will go into a convulsive kind of experience, and our church fathers were not too happy and excited about that. So, but these two forms have existed from the very, very beginning. So we know that we've had dance as an experience of worship from the very, very beginning. And there are those dance historians and liturgical dance historians who do believe, and I would agree with them, that before, as humans, we expressed any kind of worship in word and in music, we did it in body, because that's what we knew first. And then we know that in the Jewish celebration, in the Jewish religion, we have quite a lengthy history of dance. In the Old Testament, there are references to dance all over the place. And again, that has been lost in the Jewish tradition, except insofar as it is yet maintained among the Hasidic Jews, the more mystical Jews who do yet dance certain celebrations. And it has always been a desire of mine to really see some of those celebrations, though they're very often done quite privately. So I've just never been able to get to. Have any of you ever seen any of that? No? Yeah.
Are women part of that?
Probably not. The Hasidic Jews are extremely traditional in their separation of the genders, and generally it's the men. And if you may see them, I don't know where you ladies come from, but if you're in the eastern part of the United States, the Hasidic Jews will still wear very long black robes, and the men wear little black hats and long, long hair and beards. And it is the men who do the dancing. Though I think, pardon? Right, right. But of course, our references in the Bible are to women dancing. We know that Miriam, after the crossing of the Red Sea, led the women in dance and song. Judith certainly led the women. And we know about King David dancing. I mean, so we have these very, very important traditions that we tend to forget about.
I think of the Fiddler on the Roof, the wonderful scene of the wedding.
Isn't it magnificent? Absolutely,
yes.
Magnificent. Two forms of dancing in that scene, if you remember, that there was the Jewish dancing, and then the Russian. The Russian men were the ones who did the bottle dance. If I'm remembering it correctly, the Russians, as guests at the wedding, presented that wonderful bottle dance as their contribution. But the Jewish dancing was a little bit different. They danced when the bride and groom were up on the chairs. Anyway, well, indeed, I mean, this is something I will remember that dancing at weddings has been pretty much condoned all the way through. The church has never said, well, there have been people in the church who have attempted to say no dancing at weddings, but that's been a little hard to do. Well, and then Greek and Roman society, at the time of the early church, Greek society certainly had a very wonderful tradition of dancing in Greek drama. The Greek chorus was the very important element of Greek drama that commented on the action taken that was being, the decisions that were being made and the action taken by the protagonists in the Greek drama. The chorus commented on this very importantly and did so in the dancing space, which in the original theaters was the round space, and then became kind of a semi-round as amphitheaters were built with just one side. And there was a sense in the Greek society, folks, of a real body, mind, spirit togetherness, even though our philosophers will say that the dualism that we are experiencing with body and in one arena and mind and spirit in another arena was already begun in Greek philosophy. But certainly in their theatrical practices, there was not that kind of separation. Now, things changed in the Roman society. I mean, if you are students of society, you know that, of social history, you know that we got to Rome and there was a disintegration of a lot of things, and one of the things that happened is dancing became quite associated with paganism, which of course was what was the religion of the time. And there were the great bacchanals that were perpetrated under the name of Dionysus, who was the god of ecstasy. And perfectly okay. I mean, it depends upon how far you go in the direction. And of course, Apollo was the great god of serenity and wisdom and thought. And so there was a kind of split in Roman society, and as the society continued to disintegrate, movement became really quite licentious and lascivious and used for purposes of inciting a crowd to revelry that was certainly not what the early church wanted to have in its forms of worship. There was a lot of emphasis on pantomime, a lot of emphasis on grotesquery, and so we have to take this into consideration when we think about the time of the early church. Now, that doesn't mean there wasn't dancing in the early church. There was. But it was it wasn't given that wonderful, wonderful place that I would certainly like to see it have. You know what side I'm on here. And gradually and consistently, there has been an increasing condemnation of dance in the church. Now, again, there's a wonderful little book here that I just finished reading this morning, as a matter of fact, which is in the library here at Holden, The Dance and Christianity. It's 80-some pages. It will take you an hour to read. And it really pulls out the areas where dance continued to exist throughout Christianity. And if you're interested, I think you would just, you could take it out and enjoy an hour out in the sun looking at this little book. It doesn't get into real detail. It's easy to read. And it will give you a very quick overview of what has continued to exist in our celebrations within the Christian church. The Dance and Christianity by Marilyn Daniels. Now, she doesn't take it very far into our century, but it certainly is a nice little book. I have another book called Liturgical Dance, which unfortunately didn't get packed with me, and it's my it's the one I really do use for this lecture, so I can't read you the quotes that I have. But I don't want you to get the impression that there hasn't been dance. There has. But there has been this increasing condemnation. Certainly the patristic period of the church really felt that dance was intimately connected with pagan worship and idolatry, and so it was not allowed within the church. There was a developing asceticism in the church. The soul was the part of the human that was on the journey, and the body was just not a part of that journey of the soul, and there was increasingly this kind of never-ending war between the soul and the flesh, the body and the spirit. And I have my own personal strong theology that is different from that. I believe that we are body, mind, spirit in connection, And we'll get to a little bit more of that later on. So this dualism that developed between the body and the soul was not useful for the continuation of dance as a form of worship. And so there was no place for spontaneous movement in the church celebration, and there was fear of the kind of freedom that could come through dancing. Anybody want to raise a question at this point? Before I go on?
What time period are you at right now?
Well, we're...
Could this be before the monastic period?
Yes. I mean, it's a little difficult. Certainly, the dualism, I think, developed quite early on. Certainly 300, 400, 500 AD. We're already developing these ideas. Interestingly enough, there was a lot of dancing done during the monastic period. And certainly in the medieval era, we had the miracle and morality plays and the mystery plays in which there was dancing done. We had the Dance of Death, which you may or may not know about, which I can tell you a little bit about. And some of these dance forms were allowed inside the church, and some of them were allowed outside of the church. But there was still this incredible dualism that was taking place. The Dance of Death, you don't know about. Medieval form that has two possible roots. One is considered by dance historians to be the great plagues of the 1400s. I may be wrong about that. When were these great plagues? The great bubonic, 1300, the great bubonic plagues. Let's see if this little book will tell us it all. I don't get my dates real. I should be a little bit clear about that. Well, here we go. The Dance of Death. They're talking about, 1300s. So there's that one possible origin of the Dance of Death, the bubonic plagues that swept Europe and actually caused the death of 50% of the population of Europe at that time. And the thought being that the Dance of Death came into existence to give people an expression for the enormous fear they were experiencing, the anguish they were experiencing because of this incredible thing they didn't understand. I mean, this was an enormous mystery, you realize, that we did not have modern forms of medicine, and people were simply dropping like flies. The Dance of Death was generally a processional form led by death, the figure of death, and the people in the procession were dressed to signify people within certain walks of life. There were always clergy, there were always the wealthy, there were the poor, there were the nobility, there were the people who were not nobility, and the statement of the Dance of Death was that everyone was going to eventually die, that death was successful. Now, the other origin for the Dance of Death is one that's a bit more religious, perhaps, in understanding, and that has to do with people being very, very disturbed by the tremendous gulf between the haves and the have-nots, which certainly was taking place at this time, and the church was part of that. The church hierarchy was doing very well, and the peasant population was not doing so well, and this was a chance for the peasantry to express its dismay with that hierarchy in saying, death's going to get you too. So there is that sense of that origin of the Dance of Death. The mystery, miracle, and morality plays all had dance and movement in them. Some of them started in the sanctuary of the church, were later taken out into the courtyards. The high members of the church did in some areas of... Now, when I say the church, you realize I'm talking about a church that covers all of Europe, and I'm not going to get into distinctions about where some of this took place and where it didn't. But at first, in some of the churches, the church hierarchy actually took place, participated in these mystery, miracle, and morality plays. Later on, it was just the underlings in the church that were allowed to perform in these, and then came the time when anyone ordained in the church was not allowed to perform in these mystery, miracle, and morality plays. They were very exciting spectacles. It came to a situation where these became traveling plays on little carts, were taken from one little village to the next little village and put into the middle of the square, and were very, very popular as entertainment. So that's another form that we had taking place in the Middle Ages. And then there were various dancing incidences in the Renaissance, which I'm not really going to go into right now because I want to get into some of our other discussion stuff. I do want to say to you that Luther himself was not intolerant of dance. He really thought that it was perfectly okay to dance at weddings as long as modesty and decorum were preserved. And I think that you should know that when this country was founded, our Puritans were balanced in their assessment of dance. They did not believe that dance was an inappropriate thing to have. There was dancing in some of the early church activities here in this country, even though that seems very, very remote to us today. Where that all began to change is a little hard to say. There are those dance historians who believe that the Reformation was a real problem, that certainly the Reformation took us into even greater splits between the body and the mind, soul. And I think they just think they're not going to stick around. They thought we were going to dance today. Bless their hearts. And here we are doing a lecture. So tough. Again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, folks. I'm not a student of the Reformation, so if you're interested in that, you're going to have to go somewhere else. But there is the thought that the Reformation was another damper, was another blanket placed on continuing dance activities in the church. And then there is the whole problem of the Victorian era, where we became even more involved in intellectual approaches to the world, and dancing was certainly treated as a frivolity and a fetish, and it was allowed as a social activity, certainly if there were nothing erotic about it, and it had to do more with reason. It just could not be part of reason or religion at that time. I don't know, are you all aware of the development of the waltz? When the waltz first came into our social circles anyway, it was considered to be absolutely inappropriate for anybody of good standing to dance. I mean, young women were not to waltz at all, because that would be the end of their virtue. I think the expectation being that in the whirling of the waltz and in that three-quarter time, that they would get themselves into a trance state and be allowed to be whisked off into the bushes, and that would be the end. It took a long time for the waltz to be considered an appropriate social form. And of course, by the Victorian era, we are allowed to waltz in extremely formal situations. I don't think we had much waltz in the church at that time, though.
That's the case with other dances as well. Is it like the tango, I think, began as a working class, lower class dance almost as a protest?
This is generally what has happened, Dan. Even if you go way, way, way back to the origins of what we call the classical ballet, we talk about pre-classic dance forms, and they were folk forms. The courant and the allemande and the pavane and a bunch of others that I'm not remembering now, the bourré and a few other things. These were folk forms that were brought into the courts and given some dignity and some a little separation out from all that lusty stuff that was going on in the fields, and and became forms by which men and women of the courts were educated into etiquette. And of course, again, some of this was still in churches in various places. Interestingly enough, some of the historians will say, it appears in the books that I have read, that the churches that were still able to include movement were the southern churches, the more Latin churches, not the northern churches, which is sort of the heritage of Holden, if you go way back. But you're absolutely right, Dan. And we see this in our own culture. I mean, how the young will just explode into all this stuff that was done that I can't do. And it's wonderful. I mean, how else are we going to get fresh blood into some of this stuff? Well, in this country, perhaps the most the dancing that we're most aware of in church, in a church environment, is the dancing of the 19th century Shakers, if you know about the Shaker movement. In the opening decades of the 19th century, the Shakers, and the Shakers did not begin here, they had come from elsewhere. Fascinating sect of people who really believed that they were directly connected to God, and had taken as part of their theology a total separation from any carnal involvement. They did not believe in marriage, they did not believe in any kind of carnal relations, and it's interesting that that's the word that's kind of connected with the Shakers. And so they didn't perpetrate themselves, and there are very, very few Shakers left at this time, but for a while it was quite a large movement. People joined the Shaker religion, and their worship service was a service of movement. They shook themselves free of sin. And the action was, as we have had it described, a kind of pulsing and shaking of the upper part of the body that was also, you know, some part of a, it was not an Indian form, but there was lower activity too, and there were all kinds of incredible patterns that they would do as part of their religious services. They would do line dances straight down, they would do in circles, they did a circle dance of circles within circles that they felt was symbolic of the heavenly world. And when they'd shake the sin off, and then they would shake with their hands this way to receive spirit. And in the beginning of the Shaker movement, this was an extremely individualistic thing. People could move in any way they wanted to, and then as the sect grew and structured itself, these dances became quite structured and formalized. There is a
Where did you find Shakers today? In any number back east?
They're 30. I mean, I'm not. There may be 5 or 6 or 7 who are really Shakers, but there are a few around them that form a community.
That was
people. All the women.
An amazing sect. If you, again, I'm not a student of the Shakers, but
anything to do with
Yes, indeed. Very simple, beautiful things. They were concerned about their elderly and did things on diet. And
they invented many things that we still use, a lot of farm equipment and just ways of doing things, lives, because they were into simplicity of movement.
Right, right. Simplicity of living. There's a beautiful dance that has been done by one of our major modern American dancers called the Shakers, and it is it follows the form of that line dance coming down the church. Always the men on one side and the women on the other, and a beautiful moment in that dance where two young people, a young girl and a young boy, really want to find out what that's all about, and the elder, who is a woman, stops that cold. Absolutely, it's a very, very lovely dance. If you ever have a chance to see it, I hope you will. Well, now let's go into the 20th century. We're coming into the present now, folks, and I want us to have a little discussion as soon as I get through with these few comments I want to make. That one of the things that's happened in this country in the 20th century is that we have evolved a dance form that makes it a little easier for us to express ourselves in movement, our worshipful state in movement, and that's the modern dance. Now, you have to understand that I'm quite biased because I did take ballet until I was a senior. I've taken ballet all my life, but I moved into the modern dance world when I went to college. And it's a form of dance that has been developed here in this country in kind of protest against the ballet. It is not a rigid, structured form. There are not steps that you learn that have developed out of the courts of Europe. And the people who founded this movement at the turn of the century, Ruth St. Denis, Ted Shawn, and the names that come out of that are Martha Graham, Jose Limon, Doris Humphrey, Charles Wideman. Actually, Jose Limon comes out of Charles Wideman and Doris Humphrey. You don't need to know any of this stuff. I'm just name dropping. that all of these people were looking for a way of expressing spirit, their own spirit, through movement. And this was one of the reasons that they were not interested in the classical ballet, because it was too rigid and too structured for them, and too decorative. The dance as we knew it was the dance, our social dance, our performance dance, was a very decorative form and was not allowing people to really express who they were. And so the modern dance came into existence as a form in this country at the turn of the century. And people began to think, wow, now we have a chance to do some things we haven't felt we've been able to do for a while. And there have been people in this country working since the 20s and the 30s in liturgical dance. Interestingly enough, in this little book that, as I say, is here in your library, in the Holden Library, there's a name mentioned, Erika Tiemei, who came to this country from Germany and started doing some work in the 30s, was one of my teachers in Washington, D.C., and is a woman with whom I am still very much in communication. At the time I worked with her in the 60s in Washington, D.C., she was doing liturgical dance, but she wasn't telling us she was doing it, because it was just not on the rise. That was something that had been done earlier. But people have been doing it. And in 1958, there was the Sacred Dance Guild formed. This is a national organization of dancers and people interested in dance as a form of as something used in worship service, and what we feel is happening now is that there is a real beginning of an opening in the churches for more liturgical dance, And I really want to kind of stop with my formal comments at this particular point, because I really want to look at what's taking place now. Have you all talk about it, ask me questions. I want to bring up some things that I think are relevant to today. But let's just kind of open this up now. Any questions? Well, that's a very interesting question. I think the Unitarians are pretty open. I think the Congregational Church is pretty open. I think that the Disciples of Christ, in it's congregations. This is the problem. It's really hard to say that there are denominations that are more open than the other. Interestingly enough, I think the Lutherans are well ahead of the Presbyterians. I really do. And as a matter of fact, I don't have the quotes, unfortunately, because I didn't bring that book, but Vatican II has a very positive quote about the use of movement in worship. And so somewhere in one of the meetings of the Lutheran Church not too long ago, again, there was a statement about how important it is to bring movement and the arts into the worship service. And I don't have those quotes because that's a book I just didn't get here with. But I'm not clear that we can say it's particular denominations. My experience is that it's congregations and it's church leaders, and if you can begin to talk to people about including arts, then dance is one of the arts that I feel needs to be included. Now again, I'm on a particular path here, folks, as what I want to do with my life now. I mean, I have been in the dance world all my life, and my spiritual world has been over here somewhere, and I've been in the same dualistic pattern because it's just been natural. That's what I grew up with. And so I've been in tension with myself. You know, I've loved my body. I mean, I have. People think, what? Freud would really like to have to do with you, you know? I will never forget going through a very serious and strenuous psychological testing when my former spouse was being interviewed to become part of the CIA or one of those things. And I had to spend an hour with a psychologist, and I'd gone through a battery of tests, and he couldn't find anything wrong with him. And so he said, well, I don't know, what are we going to talk about for an hour? And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, what about your dancing? And I said, well, what about my dancing? He said, why do you dance? I said, well, because I like to, and I like to use my body, and I kind of like my body. He said, what? And I spent the next hour figuring out that the reason I danced and liked my body was because I was obviously very involved in Freud's whole penis envy complex. And no, I kid you not. I mean, this was in... this was in the early 1960s in Washington, D.C. I came out of there thinking, what's the matter? So, you know, I mean, the dualism exists in the dance world. And so at one point, I, some years back, looked at this professional work and my spiritual path and decided I really wanted to bring them together. So my mission for the rest of my life is to assist myself and assist other people in really seeing themselves as a wonderful connection of body, mind, spirit. And this is tough because the church is still working in a... Some parts of the church are still working in a very dualistic pattern where we believe that worship is a verbal experience, that it's the word that is important, and we've not yet begun to appreciate the fact that the word can come through our intuitive, right-brained experiences, and does not maybe have to be spoken in linear, academic, intellectual ways, that it can be spoken through poetry. I mean, the hymns that we sing, oh, wow! And what they're saying, and they're verbal, and yet they're incredibly intuitive and right-brained and beautiful. And yes, the pulse of those hymns, and indeed, I mean, I haven't figured out how to do this yet here, because when I hear this group get up and sing, there is so much energy. Why that energy can't get into a little bit of motion, I don't know, but there's something that gets people into this rigid form of, oh, we're not supposed to move. I mean, what are we taught when we go to church as kids? Sit still. Listen.
Do you think something that I was going to say, if you don't have a professional dancer in your congregation, but there are some people who would say, yeah, I'd like to move, but I don't know how, in getting over those inhibitions, I've seen professional dancers dance in a church, and it's beautiful,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But to get the people, to give people the courage and the permission to do that.
Well, this is a very key point. And let me tell you that those of us who work in liturgical dance we struggle with this. We really do, because there are a couple of issues here. One is liturgical dance a spectacle? Is it participation? And I think it's both. I think it, and you simply have to know what it is you're dealing with. I mean, last night, if you were at Vespers, you saw two kinds. Mm-hmm. You saw participation, and you saw, I mean, you were involved in participation, and the movement choir was participation, and then you saw spectacle, okay, when I did the psalm. And then we get into this whole problem with, well, should it be done by professionals who know what they're doing, or should it be done by people who don't know what they're doing? And here again, I feel that we need a real, it's wonderful if we can have both. And if we can't have both, then I am absolutely in favor of getting people who are not professionally trained to move. It is a natural form of expression. And one of the things that I have chosen to do for the rest of my life is to talk with my hands. I mean, I just decided I'm going to talk with my hands. Having been taught from the very time I was that old, nice girls don't do that,
Are you from a Northern European background?
I was reared in church Presbyterian. My father was Pennsylvania Dutch and came through the Lutheran Church. My mother was Virginian and Southern Baptist, and but Virginian in a whole different area too. But I would have to say that my religious upbringing is pretty Northern European. Fundamentalist.
This obviously is a generalization, but as a rule, it's harder for the Northern European descent people to move. I've got Greek friends that'll dance at the drop of a hat.
Right,
when they're born
right,
and raised in
right,
America.
Right. Yes,
and
yes.
Oh, and then you look at the black church, and they have no qualms about moving in worship.
Oh, I know, and I go into the black church and I think, I don't want to do that. I mean, what do you mean? Charismatic dancing. I don't know how to do that. I mean, we get caught. One of the things I found myself saying at a recent liturgical dance conference I went to in Manhattan was that here I am in this field wanting to get people to participate. Last night, watching you all do that simple little phrase just gave me chills. It was so beautiful to see the whole group do it. And yet, I, as a dancer, with my training and background and my religious upbringing, have a hard time moving in church. Don't tell anybody that. But, if there's someone else up there saying, well, now, we'd like you to just sway from side to side. I mean, my first instinct is, what for? there is that problem still in me. Yeah.
How long did you work with that group that gave
that? Did the movement choir last night?
About
a total of an hour and 10 minutes, maybe.
Because that was really lovely.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was so nice.
Well,
kids are natural. And those children, wonderful kids are natural.
Well, you had men in it, too, which was a
yeah. Well, isn't that fun? Yeah, well, I think that's probably because I was allowed to get up and make my zany announcement. But there are a couple of things here. One is that, I mean, back to your question about what do you do when you don't have a trained dancer in a church? You have to be open enough to go with the differences of people. You know, there's a tendency we have to think everybody's got to be alike. And if I had spent time to get everybody alike in that movement choir, we'd never do it. And people would have gotten so frustrated and unhappy that it just would have fallen apart. The amateur has to be careful about that. You don't have to get it looking perfect. Mm-hmm. None of us are. I mean, and none of us can do things exactly the same way. And that whole sense of ensemble, which a choir director likes to get a choir all looking the same, and you have to kind of let go of, I think.
I watched a little girl, she was just directing, so I could just see the expression in her face last night that it was doing. And it was, like you said, so natural, and she was so, it was just a beautiful thing to watch her face.
Exactly, yeah. Because whether they know
her
it or not.
Her movement was lovely, that, too, but her face, her facial expression was neat.
Yeah,
I don't know her at all.
Yeah, I don't know which one you're talking about, but yeah. Well, at some level, folks, and I don't want to get into a theological discussion here. That's not my area. I believe that as we move to rhythm, we're really getting into a worshipful state. Some of us can really do that, and all of us can do that. All of us can do that. We know that taking walks out in this beautiful environment can be a very meditative and spiritual experience. And that's why I'm so eager for everyone to just realize that moving, that just moving is spiritual.
It's a way to help you lose control, which...
The tight control of one segment of us.
Yeah. I mean, at its extreme, it becomes the ecstasy, but I guess... In my spiritual journey now, I'm trying to explore more giving myself permission to lose control,
mm-hmm.
because my life, in my upbringing was so.
Yeah.
This is what good girls do. And
yeah.
This is how
yeah.
you act.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. Can you hang on to it,
sure,
Dan? I just want to ask. I just want to answer the other thing I wanted to say about when you're working without trained dancers. The faith. In simplicity. There's a tendency for people to think that dance has to be elaborate, and it simply doesn't. It can be a flowing walk. It can be skipping. If you would break down what I've been doing here, what you've seen, it is so simple. The gesture is so simple, and sometimes I think, if there were trained dancers looking, I'd be upset. But the simplicity of a gesture here and a gesture here, and then just waving the arms, that's all that was happening last night for a whole portion of that. Anybody can do that. Anybody can do that. Now, if you want to get into fancy little dance patterns, then you're in trouble, okay? So you have to really dare to be simple. Dan.
Well, I was only going to say, in terms of, again, how we reintroduce this in our congregations, one thing that occurs to me is that what we learn two messages in many of our churches when we're children. One is that when we're sitting in the actual service, it's to sit still and stuff. But I know, as a teacher of Sunday school and having participated in that, we also teach kids to sing while moving, And we all remember those as adults. This little light of mine,
hiding
under a bush. Oh, no. We're moving. Or, head and shoulders, knees and toes. We've
right.
got all these... movements with songs, but somehow we get the message that those are not appropriate
for the big
worship,
church.
It's finding ways to reconnect those.
Well, one of the things, Dan, that I think can be done, and again, I'm saving some of this stuff for the hands-on, bodies-on session on Friday. What? Wait.
Go hiking.
That's, come on, Sue. is we can begin to introduce simply into the congregational worship, very, very gently, some gestures. And one of the ways I think is effective to do that, and I haven't done this yet, but I'd love to, is thinking about attitudes of prayer. And this would have to come from the leadership of the church. But maybe in some ways, I mean, some moments of prayer in the service, you would be asked to pray this way. Or maybe in some moments of the service, you would be asked to simply look straight forward and pray. Or some kind of gesture. You know, again, that might be hard for some people, but why are we always doing this? This is making a supplication statement that is fine for some prayers, but not for all prayers. And it might be fun for a congregation to talk about this and begin to experiment with different attitudes of prayer, just to begin to sense how the body responds differently.
Yeah, you know, there's so much around prayer, I find it for myself, anyway, there's so much pressure to conform to that one style, because much of my prayer, I would much rather be looking up and being open and seeing who I'm in community with. But boy, I find if you're in a big group and everybody else is like this and you look up and somebody else sees you looking up, it's like...
Well, Dan, you see, when you get to my age, you don't care about those things anymore. You just do it. Mm-hmm. I mean,
It's interesting that I have many Catholic friends, and Catholic churches, now we close your eyes and you don't look down. You do just, and maybe people are zoning out, not paying attention, but they always laugh about Protestants, you know, behind their head and closing their eyes. And I've noticed that as I've gone to more Catholic services.
Except that it used to be like that. Yeah. It used to be on the kneelers like this.
Yeah. So,
I don't know.
Does that signify anything? Or maybe people are just bored and they're not paying attention. But that's interesting. My first comment is I can hear people saying, oh, but I'd be so distracted I wouldn't be able to pray. I'd be, you know, thinking about how I'm supposed to hold my hands.
my response to that, and I'm really getting myself out on my theological limb here, is that when we have to leave the body in order to pray, we're doing something very strange. We're not then making prayer an ongoing part of our existence. We're saying we've got to leave this place and these people and this wonderful experience to get into some kind of state that all my senses are closed down, and then I can pray. And that's a problem for me, because what I feel what I want to find a way to do in my life is to make prayer an ongoing 24-hour-a-day experience, if that makes any kind of sense.
Oh, yeah.
And this is why I am so moved by Eucharist. And if we could only appreciate the fact that every time we eat together up there, that's Eucharist. And not, I mean, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have these wonderful transcendent moments of worship. We need those. But if there were some way we could keep making the connections.
It's always bothered me to watch people coming back from the communion table. They're coming back to like they've just lost their best friend. Been through the worst experiences of their lives. You know, and I'm going, this is supposed to be happy. You're supposed to enjoy it.
Well, there's a kind of a piousness, you know, about that. But
they don't even look pious. They just look like they're
Well, but I must say, I think Eucharist here is just exciting. I mean, the music that's sung and the exuberance of it all is just absolutely, I love it. You know, welcome to the feast. I would that the the Presbyterian experience that I had as a child, would that that could have been so celebratory. It was an incredibly solemn occasion. Yeah,
it's pretty solemn.
Folks, we're getting close to the end of our time here. There are a couple of things. I want to ask you a little bit about this business of spectacle and participation. How do you feel about that?
I love seeing spectacle. I'm not used to using that word, performance, I guess. And at the same time, it makes me want to get up and do it with them. And sometimes that's been the experience, that one or two people will perform and then do invite the congregation to join in. But, I mean, it usually brings tears to my eyes, I think, every time I've seen a sacred dance, whether I've seen evenings of liturgical dance performance and I've seen it in church services, and I never dry-eyed it through the whole thing. It moves me and it speaks to me in a way that words don't.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and I know
mm-hmm.
I'm not alone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is it becoming fairly common? I've lived out of the country for the past 20 years and only in the States for short periods of time. And so I don't know how common it is in, say, the Lutheran Church today. We've just come to the Midwest, where I'm sure it's very...
I think it is so sporadic. I don't think there's any way you can say... And again, I'm, as someone who has just been working in this area for the last 5 years and trying to find my own, you know, trying to locate the congregations that are interested, and I have not done a survey of denominations and where things are taking place.
I think you have to start with the performance, or for, like, I'm thinking of the congregation that we have just become a joint. I can't imagine the congregation doing it, but I can see where they could accept watching it, mm-hmm. seeing mm-hmm. it. So I think mm-hmm. In the very provincial communities, you would have to start with the performance. See where they would see it, not be a part of it initially.
Yeah. I think, again, there is where I am concerned. My concern is that whoever is doing the dancing or bringing the movement into the service would really move in with a real sensitivity about
right.
what the needs of the congregation are and how that congregation exactly, because this has certainly happened. We know that professional dancers have just gone in and walked over a church and put stuff in there that has been totally inappropriate and that the congregation has not been able to accept, and that's just been the killer. I mean, there are a couple of things that happen here. There are the professional dancers who want to dance, and they're not all that interested in dance as part of worship service. So when they're given an opportunity to dance, they'll move in and dance, and there's a problem there. And then there are the untrained, more charismatic people who want an opportunity to express themselves in movement, and sometimes that can be absolutely beautiful, and sometimes it could be the most embarrassing experience in the world. And that can go either way. So, I mean, these are some of the concerns that we who want to see dance grow have to talk about among ourselves.
When you were talking about the early history of dance and so on, we lived in North Africa for many years, and we were very close friends of one of Libya's finest folklore dancers, and we went often to rehearsals of theirs. They were absolutely marvelous,
mm-hmm.
and the dance, and the costuming, and the, everything was just beautiful,
mm-hmm.
very special.
Mm-hmm.
When we were exposed to that mm-hmm. so much,
mm-hmm.
This is not Black Africa, this was Arab Africa.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Really special. Mm-hmm. We spent 13 years there.
There is one thing I do want to mention. We had a wonderful conference here last February on movement and music and space, and how we can bring nonverbal elements, how we can focus on nonverbal elements in worship. And there is a real problem, folks, in churches in terms of space. Dance movement needs space. It occupies time and space and uses energy. And this is here probably one of the worst places in the world to do any movement. I mean, nobody except the people in the front row can see what's going on. And this is tremendously disturbing because movement is a visual form. Unless it's a participatory thing, if we're talking about the performance and spectacle thing, you take it in through the sense of sight. And if you can't see it, it can become an incredibly frustrating thing. And this is one of the major problems with our bus churches. And most of us know, most of our churches are that bus church with the single aisle and aisles on either side, and everybody goes in and sits in the pews gets on the bus and takes this journey that is up there somewhere in the sanctuary. Now, these are not my terms. These are Steve Elwin's terms, who was the guy who was here, the architect, in February. And so very often the dancing that takes place has to be in that teeny tiny spot up there where there's so much other paraphernalia that you can only do very small things. Or you can bring some of it down into the aisles, and some congregations can handle that and some can't. I mean, if you get too close to them, they're going to think, go away. but there are some problems here. So you have to take a look at that if you want movement in your worship services. How can it be effectively done so that it can be seen? I've gone into churches where people have wanted movement, and they give me like this little postage stamp, and then there's something over here, and there's something over here, and then they put a chair there, and then there's a microphone and a cord, and I'm saying, wait a minute. Well, we really do need to stop, folks. Anything else we can... any other questions or anything? Oh, well, you're very welcome. I certainly hope that you all will continue to develop your interest in liturgical dance and do what you can and talk to people and move and look for the resources in your area if you're interested, and think about getting in touch with people who are part of the Sacred Dance Guild. Because there might be some resources in your area if you're interested. Okay? Well, thank you very much.
The Sacred Dance Guild, where is
that? You know, that is the one. I've got it up in my room. So let me get, I have it, the address here, and I just didn't bring it down with me. So let me,
I'm going to be here a week and a half.
And I'm here till Monday, so let's connect and let me give that to you. Okay? All right? Sure, I will certainly bring it to the Friday workshop, but that's presupposing that you all have to find, I will indeed. Thank you very much for coming today, folks. If any of you are interested in reading a wonderful book on dance, Performer is Priest and Prophet, there are about 5 copies in the bookstore here. It really talks about intuition and nonverbal stuff. comes at it from a vantage point of the women's movement. And I highly recommend it to you all, so.